thank you, Philippe, and thank everybody for coming. And thank you, Philippe, for inviting me. And I believe it was Rob Speckens who suggested it. So thank you, Rob, for inviting. Good to see some familiar faces and familiar names on the screen. Be nice to actually come up and visit you guys sometime in the none too distant future. Before we start, I should introduce my coworker here. You can see in the background that is Dizzy. He will be monitoring any avian activity that's visible through the window during the duration of the talk. So I think we can all agree that that's important. So Philippe suggested that I talk about issues having to do with my book, which came out in March of this year, called Beyond Chance and Credence. That's what it looks like. And yeah, so I'm happy to do that. And that's what I'm going to be doing. So there it is. Now, the origin of the book is about 10 years ago, I wrote a paper about the use of probabilities in physics with an emphasis on statistical mechanics. And I submitted it to one of the major philosophy of science journals. I don't even remember which one at the time. And when I got the referee reports back, I realized that I probably shouldn't try to do it in a journal article length, because there's a lot of ground clearing that I think I need to do before I get to about things that I don't think work before I get to the positive account that I want to give. And just too much to do in the course of just a single paper. So 10 years later, we now have the book. So I'm going to be talking about this in an hour. And that means that there are things that I would like to be talking about that I had to omit for reasons of time. And there are also things where that I'm going to be going over more quickly than I would like to. So please, by all means, if something is puzzling to you, ask me about it during the question period afterwards. I'll get done and leave time for questions. It's probably best if I just go straight through the talk. If there's something that's puzzling you, you can save it for the question period, unless I just misspeak and I say something wrong, or if there's a glaring typo on one of the slides, in which case, you know, someone can pop up in the chat during the talk. Okay, so I want to talk about the use of probabilities in physics. And you might be saying, okay, well, actually, if you're a quantum people, then you deal with probabilities all the time. But sometimes physicists say, well, you know, I work in an area, I don't work in statistical mechanics, I don't work in quantum mechanics. Maybe I work in celestial mechanics. What do I need with probabilities? And one thing that I want to claim is that the use of probabilistic reasoning is more pervasive in physics than you would ordinarily think. And even in cases where they're not specifically mentioned, and it looks like we're making deterministic predictions, there are lurking in the background probabilistic assumptions. So, think back to the history of physics, really got started with Newton's, in modern physics, as we know, it gets started with Newton's Principia and Newtonian gravitational theory, and then GR has become very good at doing things like predicting the where planets are. And you know, it's an impressive thing. One thing that I still marvel at is I have a little app on my phone. And if I look up in the sky as I did last night and see two bright dots on the ecliptic, I can, you know, raise the phone and say, okay, that's Jupiter and that's Saturn. We've been very bright in the evening sky these days. And of course, the phone isn't actually, you know, using its camera to identify those things, is where those things are going to be in a given place as viewed from at a given time as viewed from a given place on the surface of the Earth can be calculated in advance. Right. So, so there's one kind of predictions that people make. In the 18th and 19th century, as people started collecting more and more systematic statistical information about populations, human populations, one thing that really struck the people was that if you looked at, over a fairly large population over a period of about a year, there was a remarkable regularity in, say, the number of deaths per capita or the number of violent crimes per capita or things like that. And people became aware of the existence of statistical regularities. And this was, made a great deal of impression on a lot of people. And people would talk about statistical versus dynamical regularities. So the idea is things like regularities, the planets in their motions are dynamical regularities. Those follow from the laws of physics. Statistical regularities are due to the aggregation of large numbers of individually unpredictable things. And at the same time, probability theory, as we would know it, was being developed. And people developed various versions of what we call laws of large numbers, which were thought to explain these statistical regularities. You're familiar with them. If you've got some random variable that's a sum of identically distributed independent variables, then the frequency in a string of those approaches a limit as you take more and more of them. Okay. All right, and so there's contrast. Now, one of the most profound philosophers of the 19th century, James Clerk Maxwell, made something that I'm sure struck people as a striking claim, and it was a striking claim when I heard it, is if you accept the molecular theory of matter, it's all statistical regularities. He says those uniformities, this is a quote from Maxwell, he says those uniformities which we observe in our experiments are uniformities of the same kind as explained by Laplace and wonder that by Buckle. Buckle wrote a popularization of these about statistical regularities arising from the slumping together of multitudes of cases, each of which is by no means uniform with the others. And okay, you might say, okay, no, that's not right. If I'm going to predict where Saturn or Jupiter are going to be in the sky, that's, to a good approximation, I can treat that as a bunch of gravitational two-body problems, right? Treat the Sun and Jupiter together, so Sun and Saturn, Sun and Earth. And okay, there's, regularities in what the Sun and Jupiter are doing, Sun-Jupiter system are doing are statistical regularities. But think of what you're doing when you reduce that to a two-body problem. It's actually an n-body problem where n is the number of molecules in the Sun and Jupiter. You are tracking the motion of two big balls of gas. And you're implicitly assuming that all the motion of those molecules that make up Jupiter and Saturn are going to Jupiter and Saturn and the Sun are going to average out, and in the course of the time that you want to make a prediction for, the planets aren't going to appreciably change their shape. And that regularity in the shape of Saturn and Jupiter and the Sun, that they remain more or less spheres, are statistical regularities of exactly the same sort. Of these things from population statistics that Buckle and other were wondering about. So what I claim is that probabilities are there in physics even when they're not explicitly mentioned. So the answer to probabilities, who needs them? We all do, all the time. Okay, so I want to understand the use of probability in physics. And one thing that's become fairly commonplace in the philosophical literature on foundations of probability is that there are at least two different senses in which the word has been used. And if you look at the history of discussions about probability, this goes back all the way back to the beginnings of probability theory. One is what you might call the epistemic chance, epistemic sense, having to do with degrees of belief. Degrees of belief of, I say ideally rational agent, because if we're talking about precise numerical degrees of belief satisfying the axioms of probability, that's not an accurate representation of your mental state, but you can sort of idealize and imagine an agent that did. And I'm going to call following what's standard in the philosophical literature, we're going to call those credences. And then there's what you might call the aleatory, I'm borrowing terminology from Ian Hacking, who wrote a nice book called The Emergence of Probability about the history of all this. And those are thought to be characteristic of the physical circumstances of leading up to an event. So if I flip a coin or spin a roulette wheel, or if I do a quantum experiment, we'll attribute a probability to the outcomes of those events. And those are probabilities that can be changed when you change the physical setup. And the idea, and we usually think that the probability of an outcome, say of a roulette wheel, can change without anybody's degree of belief changing. So that if the wheel develops a irregularity, there might be a bias towards part of the wheel that no one knows about. And we can test to see if there's such a bias. So these are thought to be characteristics of the physical circumstances leading up to the ball landing. Sorts of things that can change when the physical circumstances change, whether or not anybody's degree of belief changes. So they're not the same as what's on the other in the other column. And following the philosophical terminology, I'll call those chances. And what I want to say is stress is we should think of these as just two different senses in which the word probability has been used. It would be a mistake, I think, to say, well, we have to pick one to the exclusion of the other. And so if you have a temptation to say, well, what is probability? Is it epistemic or is it physical? Well, there's an epistemic concept, which we're going to call credence. There's a physical concept, which we're going to call chances. And they're related, of course, and they interplay with each other, but what we shouldn't do is say, you know, if I think it makes sense to model the degrees of belief in an agent by numerical credences satisfying the axioms of probability, then I'm ipso facto have to deny that it makes sense to talk about these physical chances. Right. Okay. So, and if you look at discussions, you see, in the 18th and 19th century, you'll see people explicitly distinguishing between these two concepts. Now, you'll also see, if you look at history of discussions of probability, worries about whether this physical notion of chance is compatible with determinism. Because, presumed that the laws of physics were deterministic, or everybody who is involved in these discussions, usually on the basis of some kind of either of God's foreknowledge or a basis of sufficient reason or a principle of sufficient reason or something like that. And so you found people saying, well, look, because we all know that the laws of physics are deterministic, then the only, there actually are no chances in the world, and probability has to be wholly epistemic. And so here's a typical quotation from Bernoulli's book, The Art of Conjecturing. In themselves and objectively, all things under the sun, which are, were, or will be, always have the highest certainty, but seen in relation to us, the certainty of things is not the same for all things, but varies in many ways, increasing and decreasing. Probability indeed is degree of certainty, and you'll find similar things in Laplace and others. But there's a tension in these writers, because even though their official view is that probability is to be used in a wholly epistemic sense, they slide into talking about probabilities of games of chances and things like that as being features of the physical setup. So here's Bernoulli from the same book talking about games of chances. The originators of these games took pains to make them equitable by arranging that the numbers of cases that result in profit and losses be definite and known, and that all cases happen equally easily. And what he means when he says they happen equally is we're going to assign equal probabilities to them. And you'll find similar things in Laplace. Okay. And that sounds as if whether or not a die is fair is a feature of the physical setup. That all sides, rolling a one occurs equally easily as rolling a six. Okay. And so there seems to be a need, even what we're finding in these writers is that taking a purely epistemic view of probability sort of leaves a hole. There seems to be a need for a concept of chance in which there is a matter of fact about the chance of getting a six on the die, and claims about these chances can be tested empirically. Okay. And if you say, okay, you can have that as long as you accept indeterminism in fundamental physics, they say, I worry about that, because you know whether or not what a fundamental physical theory would be like if we ever have one is a very deep question. And the question of whether or not it makes sense to test a roulette wheel to see if there's a bias doesn't seem to be the same sort of question. Okay. And I claim that if you look at writings in typical statistical mechanics textbooks, the tension remains. If you look at a standard statistical mechanical textbook, probabilities are usually said to be introduced because of our ignorance of the microstate of the system. You know, we don't have full knowledge of the system. And even if we per impossibile somebody were to hand us a full specification of a macroscopic system, there's nothing we could do with it. You know, we couldn't solve an n-body problem or keep track of these things, right? And then the same textbooks will usually say for various equilibrium situations, here are the probability distributions you use. So for an isolated system with a definite energy, use the microcanonical distribution. For a system in contact with a heat bath, you use the canonical distribution. And there's some talk about the justification for that, but very often they say, ultimately the choice is to be justified by agreement with experiment. And you gotta go, okay, what's going on here? Because one thing you're not doing if you're testing these probabilistic hypotheses by experiment is you're not learning about your state of knowledge of the system. You seem to be learning about something about the system. So it seems that we seem to be using both epistemic and objective conceptions in an inconsistent manner. And this is sort of what got me started thinking about these. So question is, does determinism make nonsense of the idea there's a matter of fact about such things as a bias of claims about which are subject to empirical test? Or there's a matter of fact about the probability of a certain variable taking on a certain value if a system is in contact with the heat bath that we can subject to empirical test? Okay. Now, one of the reasons I thought I had to do some ground clearing in order to write this book, or in order to give my positive account, is there's things out there in the literature, and some of you might be saying, okay, you know what, I know the answer to this, that things that I claim do not work. So one is, there's a long history of the idea that probability just has to do with counting of possibilities. And the reason, so going back to Boltzmann, for example, we have arguments that the reason that a system left to itself approaches equilibrium is that equilibrium is just the largest macrostate, overwhelmingly, right? And identifying then the probability of a given state with, say, the given macrostate with its phase space volume. Yeah. Well, one thing, if you're going to count possibilities, you're going to have to divide the possibilities up into which ones you regard as equally probable, or in Laplace's terminology, equally possible. And so it requires, and that's going to require some kind of justification. You know, there might be different ways of counting according to which you have very different probabilities, right? And the other thing I'm going to claim doesn't work is attempts to define objective probabilities in terms of frequencies. And this, since this is an audience of physicists, I suspect that a lot of you have encountered the idea that single case objective probability doesn't make sense, that if you're talking about probabilities in physics, there's always an implicit or explicit reference to some ensemble of systems, and it makes no sense to talk about probability of an individual event. Okay, that actually is something that I'm going to want to reject. Something that I'm going to reject. I don't think it works. It does the job that it's supposed to. Okay. On counting possibilities, here's a little mini dialogue. Here's Laplace saying the definition of probability is the ratio of number of favorable cases to that of all cases possible. That's from his philosophical essay on probabilities, the principle one. And then immediately, he says, hold it, wait. And what he calls principle two is actually a correction to his principle one. He says, but that supposes the various cases equally possible. And if they're not so, we'll determine first their respective probabilities, whose exact propitiation is one of the most delicate points of the theory of chance. So there are examples of people going very badly astray by analyzing some situation with an inappropriate division of the possibilities into equal probable cases. And he's right about this. And one of the reasons I'm quoting Laplace is that people have sometimes attributed to him a naive view according to which probability is just counting cases. And there's also out there in the literature the idea that there's something called a principle of indifference, which is supposed to uniquely fix probabilities in the state of complete ignorance. And that's often attributed to Laplace. I don't think there is such a principle. I don't think you can state it in a non-vacuous way. And certainly Laplace did not think there was such a principle. Okay, so I've already mentioned probability of statistical mechanics. Very common view is the probability of a macro state is just the size of the state. And then you have to say, well, what do we mean by size? And you get the answer. For a system with definite energy, in classical mechanics, it's a microcanonical measure. In quantum mechanics, will be a dimension of a subspace. And with Laplace, we said, well, what's special about this way of counting? So there will be a multitude of measures on the phase space. Some of these measures, the equilibrium macrostate will be large. On other measures, it'll be small. In quantum mechanics, you might say things are easier because we've got finite number of possible states. But what you mean by that is I have a finite dimensional subspace, my Hilbert space. There's actually a continuum of possible states in any finite dimensional subspace. And what you want to say is the system, we can treat the system as if its state is a mixture of energy eigenstates equally weighted. So that's a very particular kind of probability distribution. We say, well, why is this? And I think that if you ask for the rationale of those, there are good reasons, but they have to do with the process of equilibration. That basically erases the history of it and leaves a thing in a state where that is actually, represents the best you can do in terms of probabilities of states. So that has to do with the dynamics of the system. It's not, in spite of what some statistical mechanics textbooks say, it's not based on a principle of indifference. And the rationale for using it in particular does not transfer to non-equilibrium situations. It would be only appropriate to use these ways of counting and count them as giving you probabilities for a system that's been left to itself long enough for it to equilibrate. Okay. On the second thing that I said didn't work, on frequentism, there certainly are connections between chances and relative frequencies. So for example, we're all familiar with these examples. You've got N balls in an urn, M of which are black, and you're choosing them to a ball in such a way that each ball is equally likely. And then the chance of getting a black ball is just the relative frequency in the urn of black balls, M over N. You might say, well, what we really mean is relative frequency in an infinite series. You know, this what the infinite, you know, there's a strong law of large numbers. In an infinite series of probabilistically independent events, each of which has the same probability, then with probability one, the relative frequency will converge to P. So let's just, you know, define the probability of those individual events as that relative frequency that number that the relative frequency is going to converge to. And these both of these are correct, but they don't suffice as a way of telling us what we mean by chance or what we mean by probability. And the easiest way I know to see that is that both of those links between chances and relative frequency require a notion of probability distinct from relative frequency to even say. So in that first one, you know, I had to stipulate that the each ball was equally likely to be drawn, right? And because if it's not, then the chance of drawing a black ball is not equal to the relative frequency. And in the strong law of large numbers, it comes up twice. One is you stipulate that the distinct events are probabilistic independent. And then the conclusion is something that, you know, it's not true that all possible sequences are going to have a relative frequencies that converge to P. It's just that with probability one, we're going to get one of those sequences that does. Okay, so where does this leave us? So what I want to claim is there's an important legitimate role for a notion of chance such that, one, the value of a chance doesn't depend on what anyone thinks of it. Two, it does depend on the physical features of the chance setup. And if you want to know, say, about, you know, what the chance of decay of a certain atom is in a certain interval of time, what you can do is you can do experiments. And frequencies of outcomes in experiments are often very good evidence about chances, but that doesn't mean that those frequencies are to be identified with chances. And so if there's some disagreement about whether a roulette wheel is biased or not, you can run a test. And I'm claiming the best way to think about that is we're testing hypotheses about the values of chance. And such that we can explain why we should expect there to be statistical regularities of the sort we observe. And, you know, use of this notion doesn't require the commitment to indeterminism in fundamental physics. I don't know what ultimately fundamental physics is going to look like. I know we're not there yet. It could be a fundamentally indeterministic theory. It could be a fundamentally deterministic theory. It could be something that we haven't thought of. You know, these are deep questions about the nature of reality, about future physics. And I'm just talking about fairly banal uses of chance in everyday life. Okay. And that's basically what I set out to do in this book is to tell you about a notion of chance that satisfies that. Okay, and the main conclusion of the book is that you need to go beyond that familiar dichotomy of credence and chance that I mentioned on an earlier slide. And I introduce a third notion, a hybrid notion that I call epistemic chance that combines both epistemic and physical features. Okay. As you may have noticed, I find it useful to look back at the history of discussions of probability because I find it's very often the case that even though there's a lot of confusion in the early days of a subject, also those who are formulating a subject for the first time are thinking fairly deeply about it. And so a clue that's on, I think it's on the right track, is that Bernoulli and Laplace and Cournot and others, even though their official view is that probability is wholly epistemic, they do talk about some things occurring more easily than others, and of that as being a feature of the physical setup. And I think there's something correct about that. It is harder to balance a pencil on its point than it is to lay it down flat. And this is, doesn't have to do merely with us, our clumsiness of human beings. If you were to try to think of some kind of physical process in nature that would reliably land pencils on their points rather than laying down flat, you'd be hard pressed to do so. Okay, so I'm going to introduce the concept I want to talk about via an illustration of a particular fictitious physical system, because I think it it's easy to analyze precisely, and I do think that it has a lot of the salient features of real physical systems to which we apply these probabilistic reasoning. So here's this gadget that I call a parabola gadget. So it's a board 1 meter square on which is inscribed a parabola and a diagonal. The parabola touches the bottom corners and it touches the top. So you can see that. And there's also a ball. And the ball starts out somewhere on the diagonal. And once you set, it's got a switch on the side, so you can set that darn thing running. And what it does once you set, set it running is the ball starts out on the diagonal and it moves vertically towards the parabola until it hits it. So up if it needs to go up to hit the parabola, down if it's already above it. Then it moves horizontally left or right to the diagonal until it hits it. And then that repeats. So here's a few iterations of that. And each one of those iterations takes the same amount of time. So you think of this as ticking off regular regular intervals. In fact, you can think of it a discrete time device. Yeah, there's where it is on the diagonal at the nth iteration, where it is on the diagonal at the n plus oneth iteration. Okay, let's play a game. You can't see it, it's just out of sight, but I've got one of these things running. And I set it running this morning. And I dropped it on the floor before I set it running. So I didn't take any particular care as to where the butt, when it's not running, the ball just sort of slides loosely on the diagonal. I didn't take any particular care where to put the ball when to start it. Okay. So it's been running. It's been running actually hundreds of iterations. Which do you regard as more probable? The ball is within 10 centimeters to the right side, so there's option A, or it's in this 20 centimeter band on either side of the center, so that's option B. So imagine, if you don't like to gamble, imagine that there's some, some reward that you like that you can get. You can either choose to get the reward if A is true or to get the reward if B is true. Of course, could be neither. But if you had to choose between getting a reward if A is true and getting a reward if B is true, which would you choose? Okay, so everyone think a moment. I already said that. Okay, so imagine two agents, Alice and Bob. Bob is a fan of the principle of indifference. He thinks there is something, such a thing. He thinks that the probability is just a matter of counting states. And there's just more room in B than there is A. In fact, there's twice as much room in B as there is in A. So he says, well, look, the B states are, the set of B states is twice as big as the set of A states. So the ratio of their probabilities is 2. This is a no-brainer. I'm going to pick 2. Okay. Alice stops and thinks, hearing what Bob says, okay, there's something kind of funny about Bob's degree of belief that, you know, not necessarily incoherent, but, you know, his degree of, there's something strange about his degree of belief that B is twice as likely as A, because if you consider the set of things that in a given iteration are in B, in the next iteration, they all end up in A. So it's because of the dynamics of the thing, being in A on the N plus first iteration has to be at least as likely as being B in B at the nth. It's just incompatible with the dynamics of of the gadget that B is twice as likely as A on any two successive iterations. And Bob doesn't know exactly how many iterations this thing has been running. There's something odd, you know, there's something odd about, you know, it doesn't amount to probabilistic incoherence, but there's something odd and unstable about Bob's reasoning. Okay. And so, you know, rather than considering the sizes of the sets in B and A, Alice can think, okay, let's think about the sizes of conditions that lead into B and A. And if you can just look, the set of conditions that put you in A, even though A has a width of 10 centimeters, the set of conditions that put you in A has a bigger width. And initial probabilities will tend to go into ones, she says, to give more weights to the extremes. And so she hasn't done a calculation, but she's betting on option A. Okay. Now, what we've seen is something I'm sure that's familiar to everybody, that given a system and dynamics, it makes sense to use the dynamics to evolve probability distributions over the state space. So as we have a physical system like the parabolic gadget or anything else you might want to take, and a dynamical map that takes a state at time T naught to a state at time T1, if you have a probability distribution over states at time T0, then that the dynamics induces a map from P0 to P1 over states, probability distributions over states by one. Familiar way to do it, the probability that at time T1, the state is in some subset of the state space is that, I'm sorry, that's a typo. That should be at time T0. I'm gonna fix it right now because I've actually used these slides several times and never noticed that one. It's a probability, at T0, the state is one that gets mapped into a state in S by the, okay. So we're just familiar with that, I think. Okay, so if we start thinking about how probability distributions over the state of the parabola gadget involved, and you start playing with different probability distributions, different density functions, perhaps, and just you know, do a little, write a little Mathematica or Maple or whatever your favorite thing is programmed to evolve those probability distributions. There's a tendency for very different probability distributions about initial conditions to read virtually the same distributions about states of affairs, even a few iterations in the future. So suppose we start with a uniform distribution over the diagonal, flat density. After five iterations, it goes into a density that looks like this. Now suppose, you know, you've got someone who sets the initial conditions with a bit of a shaky hand, and so you've got something that's peaked at 0.3 with a width of about 0.1, and say what happens in five iterations. Well, it goes into something that's virtually indistinguishable from the flat distribution. And the tendency to that, that's after just five iterations, the tendency to do this gets more and more pronounced as you go further and further out. Okay. So there's a measure on the parabola, the state space of probability object, which has the status of an attractor measure, that a wide range of measurements over initial conditions yield virtually the same probabilities for conditions after 5 or 10, or, you know, as I said, it's more pronounced as the more iterations you go. And that attractor measure is invariant under evolution. Okay, so just going back to some, you know, I want you to be thinking about real physical situations. You know, if it's in with statistical mechanics and why we would use certain kinds of probability measures over a system that's had time to equilibrate, the idea is that probability distributions, there'll be attractor measures, and those will be the standard equilibrium measures that will be approached by a wide range of probability measures over initial conditions. And okay. And so that's not just a matter of, you know, measuring length along the diagonal or anything about the structure of the state space. It's picked out by the dynamics of the system. And on that that measure, if you do the calculation, you know, you can sort of eyeball it and kind of guess that A has bigger measure than B, and the ratio is about 8/5. And so if Alice is saying to herself, okay, that measure is the one to use for a system that's been left on its own to evolve for many, many iterations, then yeah, A is a better bet than B. And that's a fact about the dynamics of the system. Okay. Now, it's not the case that every probability distribution over initial conditions will give you A more probable than B after 10 iterations or 5 iterations or something like that. So, you know, imagine Bob thinks after 5 iterations at equal intervals of the diagonal are equally probable. That won't be a violation of probabilistic incoherence, because there are probability distributions over initial conditions that do it. And here's one density function for that will do it. Now, the feature of that is that you can take, you know, small intervals and ask how the probability changes if you change the position of that interval just a little bit, and it changes a lot. So it's a feature of this probability distribution that small changes to a set of states can result in very large changes to the to the probability. And if you ask, like, so my claim is that a probability distribution like that, even though it doesn't violate probabilistic coherence, it's a well-defined probability distribution. There's something odd and something, in fact, unreasonable about that if Bob adopts credences like that, because there's a real sense in which it pretends to more precise knowledge than he does, in fact, have. And if, you know, if you have only vague or imprecise knowledge about that, then if we're going to represent your credences about a initial conditions, they, you know, should be. I'm not claiming that there's any principle that will uniquely pick one out, but it shouldn't be one that varies drastically when small changes to a set of states are made. Okay. So this is pretty much what I say. All right. And also, if I have a probability distribution over initial conditions that makes B more probable than A after N iterations, not only will that vary very rapidly over the space of initial conditions, then provided it can be represented by density functions, then go further into the future after sufficiently many iterations, A becomes more probable than B. So one of the reasons that I chose this example is it's actually not difficult to prove, and it's a theorem that's known in the literature on chaos, that any probability distribution that can be represented by a density function converges towards that invariant distribution. Okay, another game. 1,000 parabola gadgets has been running for a while. You know, which do you regard as more probable? One, that more of them have their balls in region A than region B, or that more of them have their balls in region B than region A. So out of these 1,000, we're going to look at the subset that has their balls in region A and the subset that lives in region B. Again. So what should we do bet on? Well, here's a case where we can apply a law of large numbers and believing in B more strongly than A requires absurdly precise knowledge of initial conditions. And this is a condition where I can say, you can predict with virtual certainty that A will be true. Okay, and there's a feature of a set of 1,000 gadgets that can be predicted with near certainty, not in spite of sensitivity to initial conditions, but because of it. It's the fact that these gadgets exhibit sensitivity to initial conditions that these probability distributions over initial conditions tend to smear out and approach this invariant one. So, okay. All right. So here's what I want to propose. So there's a host of mathematical theorems about systems like this, where you start with a probability distribution over initial conditions and see what happens if you evolve it. And for a, for certain kinds of dynamics, you'll find this phenomenon of convergence of probability distributions that I've been talking about, and that's well studied. And you say, well, what's the status of the probability distributions over the initial conditions? And I've been talking as if they're degrees of belief, Alice's, Bob's, credences about initial conditions. And I want to run with that. So suppose we've got, for some physical system, right, we've got some limitation of control over the state of time zero and knowledge about it. So we're not in a position, so there, for example, there is one point on the diagonal, which is a stationary point, you know, the point where the parabola meets the diagonal. If it's there, exactly there, it'll stay there forever. There are cycles of period of two, right, where it will return after two iterations to where it was, et cetera. But all of those are dynamically unstable. That if you're take a point on a periodic trajectory and perturb it even slightly, then it's going to diverge from it. So suppose you have some don't have perfect godlike control over the state of the system or perfect godlike knowledge about it. And you've got some judgment about what credences about initial states are reasonable given this knowledge. So I haven't made any attempt to specify an exact, precise, reasonable credence function or either Alice or Bob over initial conditions. Because I don't need to. You know, as long as they have this feature that, you know, they don't pretend to impossibly precise knowledge about this initial state, you know, it's okay. Yeah, dynamicals take laws taking initial state and a later state. And in the case of the parabola gadget, the only variable we really had was position on the diagonal. For real systems consisting of many molecules, there's going to be all kinds of dynamical variables, but only some of those are things that we're going to be interested in making predictions about or having probabilities about results of experiments, because only some of those are going to be macroscopically measurable. Okay, so suppose we have that, right? And then what the dynamics need things to do is they don't erase all differences between initial probability distributions, but they can make them very, very small. So at a certain point, differences between probability distributions are going to be regarded as negligible. Okay, then any credence function about state at time t0 can be evolved to yield probabilities about the state at time t1. And so here's this notion that I want to define a Colle epistemic chance. If for some number of probability p, every credence function in this class that you regard as reasonable ones about initial conditions gets evolved into the same probability within epsilon, then we're going to say, so if the dynamics has this feature of turning all reasonable credences about initial conditions into ones that agree close enough about the probability of A, then we're going to say that that probability that they all come close to agreeing on is the epistemic chance of A at T1. Okay. And that notion that I just defined on the previous stage doesn't fit into this dichotomy that I had an earlier slide of chance and credence, because they're not credences. And the way to say that, see that, is that they're what happens to agents' credences when, about initial conditions or conditions at time zero when evolved according to the actual dynamics. And that actually might be very different from anybody's credences about state at T1. So if a roulette wheel is in fact biased, then it might be that the epistemic chances that as I defined them on the previous slide are not in fact equal for every slot. Because reasonable credences about initial conditions of spins get taken by the dynamics into things that are, say, might be different for one slot than another. But if no one knows about it, then Alice and Bob might be betting at equal odds on every slot. They might, their credence for each slot might actually be equal. Right. Okay. And they're not objective chances, because if objective chances are meant to be things that events have by their nature without considerations of limitation or knowledge. Right. So I said these in an opposite order. So they're neither chance nor credence. Okay. So what I want to claim is things, pretty much anything where you can think of where, outside of quantum considerations, where there's a well agreed upon the thing that we think of as an objective chance. So games of chance and the sorts of systems we successfully apply statistical mechanics to, they satisfy the right sort of conditions for the existence of these epistemic chances. And I've got a chapter in my book where I talk in more detail than I can in this talk about the use of probability and statistical mechanics. And I want to say that they actually are well suited to play the role of our use of probabilities and statistical mechanics. So conclusion, dynamics of system can pick out a special class of measures for systems when evolving a while. Means that, like, if you're thinking about foundations of statistical mechanics, I urge people to stop. And so much of the philosophical literature on foundations of statistical mechanics talks about volume in phase space or dimension in Hilbert space. And I think that if we're going to say those are the right measures to use in a system of equilibration, we need to look more about equilibration results, because, you know, that's, and that's how I think of the equilibration results, as results about evolution of a wide range of probability distributions over initial conditions towards the standard probability distributions for the sorts of variables that we're interested in, not necessarily for all variables of the system. Okay. And one thing that I think confuses people is, you know, once they get the idea that probability is measure of state space, then, and things equilibrate because they're just more equilibrium states than there are non-equilibrium states, then they get, then they take that to the logical conclusion and say, well, I should have expected everything to have always been in equilibrium. And then you think, okay, there's something wrong. There's something wrong, and then we have to patch that up with some kind of unjustified hypothesis. We just hypothesized that what our observations are telling us about the early universe are in fact correct, and that we're not in fact Boltzmann brains. I think that's a symptom that something has very seriously gone wrong, because you never had any reason to use those measures as measures of probability, except for systems that have been had time to equilibrate, and the universe as a whole has not. Okay, thank you. There's a lot more to be said, and if you're hopefully you'll be interested, and you can buy the book. It's available both in hardcover and in ebook form. And that's it for me. I told you I was going to leave some time for questions.
Thank you very much for the very nice talk. So we have plenty of time for questions. So anybody can raise their hand. Marina?
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, I don't know if I misunderstood something, but my question is, when you were talking about the parabola gadget, you said that in this gadget, the same length does not mean same probability. So I suppose that in statistical physics, this translates to you are denying the ergodic hypothesis that says that all microstates are equally probable?
Nope.
No?
Okay, so the ergodic hypothesis says that, so suppose you have a system that is ergodic. Then that says, that tells you about long run relative frequencies in almost all initial states. Okay. So what does that have to do with probability? Well, if I have a system that, you know, and I don't have enough, I don't have a lot of control over initial, very much control over initial conditions, and I leave it alone a long time, and then observe it at a random time, then for that kind of setup, yes, the probability, if the system's ergodic, for that kind of setup, the probability will in fact be equal, you know, proportional to the measure phase space. But that's because the system has had a time, a certain amount of time to equilibrate. So the parabola gadget is in fact provably ergodic. So that's one of the reasons why I chose it. Right. And so that means, and right. And you might say, well, gee, I thought, you know, ergodic meant that equal intervals are of equal probability, but then the question for you is, well, how are you measuring length on the diagonal? If you use centimeters, then equal intervals don't have the equal probability on this ergodic measure, this stationary measure. But I can always do a change of variables, so that in terms of that variable, equal intervals do have equal measure on that measure. In fact, that's what you're going to do if you want to prove theorems about the parabolic gadget. You're going to make a change of variables to that variable. So if someone tells me equal volumes of phase space have equal probability, I'm going to say, well, what are you using to measure equal volume? And you say, well, I'm using the microcanonical measure. And what is special about that measure? And the answer is that's the attractor measure. That's the one that things tend to approach as the system equilibrates. And so it would be wrong to, if you say, if I've got a system, if I know it's ergodic and, you know, it's been prepared in some state and I don't know what state it's been prepared in, but if it hasn't had time to equilibrate, then I don't have any reason to say that equal volumes of phase space are of equal measure. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Andrea?
Hi, thanks a lot for the talk. I find your ideas on probabilities like extremely illuminating, and especially like saying that it's not like a complete dichotomy between objective and credence, but they have to kind of be married somehow. Mm-hmm. But that's been said, so the starting point to define these time chances to like determine which probability distributions are somehow acceptable.
Right.
And then also defining a distant measure between different probability measures. Yeah, so this epsilon here and then the class C.
Yeah.
And what would you reply to somebody who's being skeptical and would say something like, well, you're imposing a probability distribution on top of probability measures, and what justifies that probability distribution on top of probability measures?
Okay, I'm not sure I understand what you mean by imposing a probability distribution on top of probability measures.
So somehow, if I give you like the uniform distribution, you say, okay, that's an acceptable one. It's got like a certain amount of weight. And if I give you that one that is like this, you will say, well, no, that's not an acceptable one. You're giving it a low weight.
Right. So I think, you know, I wouldn't call that a probability distribution over probability measures, but judgments of reasonableness.
But in a way, it's like giving us, so it's like a volume measure on the space of probability. You're like giving a score to every.
Why are you resisting me recasting this in terms of degrees of reasonableness? Why does it have to be a probability or?
No, it's just it's just assigning a number to if it's a reasonableness.
Right. And actually, no, you know, there's no way to assign a precise number, right? Yeah. Right. So thank you, because that's a very important question. So when you're talking about credences, degrees of belief, right? People who work in subjective probability, there's different attitudes that they take. There are people who are called objective Bayesians who claim that for any given body of knowledge, there's one unique reasonable credence given that body of knowledge, right? And I just think that the attempts to define such a thing have been a total disaster. Then there's the other extreme, which is anything goes as long as it satisfies the axioms of probability, as long as it's coherent. And you'll see Definetti saying things like that, right? And then in between are various versions of what my mentor Abner Shimoni called tempered personalism. So you're not trying to choose a correct probability distribution as the right one, but you're also not saying anything goes, right? And the term tempered personalism, the word tempering can mean moderating something, but when you temper steel, it also makes it stronger, right? Yeah, right. So I'm presuming some kind of tempered personalism, and actually I think that we all are tempered personalists when it comes to degrees of belief, in spite of, occasional avowals in the literature, we don't in fact think that all coherent credence functions are reasonable. And the example I use in the book is inspired by a movie that has not achieved the status of a classic, but I watched in my youth and you are too young to measure, remember. It's a movie from the 1970s called Support Your Local Gunfighter. It stars James Garner. And at several points in the movie, he becomes absolutely convinced that the next role, he's in a casino, and he becomes absolutely convinced that the next role of the roulette white roulette wheel will land on 23, and he just bets all his money, everything he owns, on it. Right now, if you had a friend in that state of mind, I think that you would try to stop him. You do not in fact regard that as reasonable. It would be only a reasonable credence for a supernatural being that had an impossible level of precision of knowledge about all the states, physical states of affairs that influence the outcome of that roulette wheel. So I think we all indeed have those judgments. And use your own judgments that you already have. And if someone says, no, like for philosophical reasons, I think I want to try to think myself into a state where I actually do believe that the only criterion is probabilistic coherence, I would say no, don't do that. So I don't have anything better than that, though. What I can say is that you have access to the world that has built-in error distributions. There's a certain amount of precision that the instruments you have, whether it be your eyes or your hands or your instruments. And so I don't think my probability distribution, if I'm, my knowledge about the state of the system comes only from looking at it. I don't think that the density function for my credence should vary quickly over distances that are small compared to the visual resolution. Or if you've got some in the book I use, I imagine that Alice and Bob have a electron microscope with an error distribution of 1 nanometer. And I just say, all I need to do is assume that the probability that these density functions don't vary very much over distances of a nanometer. And you get, I don't remember, like in something like a, for all such probability distributions, you get A more likely than B after like a dozen iterations or something like that. So I think we all in fact do have not precise numerical degrees of reasonableness that we attach to credence functions, but fairly fairly vague judgments about what are reasonable and what are not. And that's all I need, if you just use those.
Okay, thanks for the complete answer. I would ask one more question, but I want other people to have a chance to talk to you in case I.
Yeah, we can talk. We can talk on. If we run out of time today, we can talk more some other time. But
sure.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, then we have a question by Matt.
Hi, Matt.
Sent me. Hi, Wayne.
Are you outside?
Yeah, I'm actually waiting for a bus to the airport right now. So sorry about this. I hope it's not too noisy.
Are you in Pittsburgh?
Yes, I am. I'm in Pittsburgh, and I'm on my way to Paris.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm really glad that you sent out an email about this talk today, because I've been wanting to talk to you about this book. And I think the most important question I want to ask you right now is going to take us a bit afield. So let me say a little bit to catch everyone up. So, you know, there are those who think that any event that's possible should have a non-zero chance or probability. We should have a system of probabilities or some other representation of credences and chances where even a single point on a continuous dartboard gets a non-zero probability. And
okay.
You can do this. And you can do this in various ways, like using infinitesimal chances, or just abandoning numerical representation and going to some kind of a relational representation of chances, right? This is more likely than 2 + 2 = 5, but less likely than hitting one of these larger area sections of the dartboard. That's right. And I'm sure you're familiar with Timothy Williamson's argument against that, in which he imagines two sequences of coin flips. And he asks, what is the chance that an infinite sequence of coin flips will come up all heads?
Right.
Of course, by standard representations, the probability is zero. And but it's also strictly possible. So those who believe in regularity or think that that's important say, well, we should represent by an infinitesimal or something like that.
Right.
And then Williamson says, well, look, what if I ask, what's the probability that every coin flip after the first comes up heads? Well, that has to be twice as likely as the probability that every coin flip.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way that can happen, even if you use type real numbers or real numbers, the only way that can happen is if the chance of each is zero.
Okay.
All right. And so, but okay. So, sorry. Too much. Let me just zoom in on the question I will ask you. Williamson's argument really seems to depend on the assumption that chances are determined by intrinsic qualitative properties of the events and the setup, and not by, for example, relations between physical setups and physical events. And I'm wondering whether there's anything about your conception of epistemic chance implies that chances should be determined by local qualitative intrinsic circumstances.
Not at all.
Not at all. Yeah. So
for and, example, and so all of this discussion about infinitesimal probabilities and things and regularity and stuff like that is completely orthogonal to anything that I'm concerned with. And let me tell you why. So I've been sort of entertaining the fiction that we can represent Alice and Bob's credences by precise real number credence functions. Right. You know, and, I quote, I.J. Goode in the book that it's, let me get the quote actually. Yeah, it would be only a joke if you were to say that the probability of rain tomorrow, however sharply defined, is 0.305786289. Like if someone said that's your credence in rain tomorrow, you'd laugh, right? Or you'd think that the person was nuts, right? We actually have fairly vaguely defined credences. For certain purposes, it can be useful to ignore that fact and treat people as if they have precise credences. But as a matter of fact, I don't think, it's actually important to me that none of this requires there to be precise credences about states at T0, because suppose I represent a credal state by a set of credences, then, the dynamics can narrow that set. Right? And, if you pay attention to this last line here, epistemic chances are not precisely real numbers.
Sure.
if for some number P, every credence function is within epsilon P, we see P is an epistemic chance of A at T1. There's not going to be a unique, they're not going to be a unique real number that satisfies that, but they're all going to be within epsilon of each other. So it doesn't matter. So now if you want to say, okay, I want to imagine agents. And so what I say in the book about this sort of thing is that, you know, I agree with this page 246. I agree that with Good, that it's a bit of a joke to pretend that credences are point valued. To take real value credences be insufficiently precise and require infinitely more precision than the real number of forwards is to take the joke too far. Now, if you want to say, okay, no, like ideally rational agents will have infinitesimal valued credences. Nonetheless, if I, you know, model them via, say, the way Bentzi and Venmacher and Horsten do, then for everyone, so, you know, they've got this, this non-Archimedean field, but every point in that field is in, what do you call a set of points that are only infinite, they're equivalence classes of things that are infinitesimally different from each other. And so they're all going to be, only infinitesimally different for some real number. And just, take what I said about real numbered initial credence functions to be the real part of those infinitesimally valued credence functions. Right. So, there might be two. So really, if there's two states that, if there's two sets that differ on, and I also talked about really about credences of outcomes of experiments and things like that. And, so if there are two states that differ on, two sets of states that differ on a set of measure zero, and one of them strictly included in the other one, you want to say your credence is strictly greater than that, fine, good. But I don't really care because, your experiment's not going to distinguish between those two states. In fact, given an experiment you're going to do, it's, there's going to be sets of finite that differ by a finite non-zero amount that your experiments can't distinguish between. Yeah, so all of that is orthogonal to everything I'm concerned with.
Okay, then we have a question by Rob.
Hello.
You're muted, Rob.
Sorry. So at first, I apologize. Caveat that I have to leave in precisely 11 minutes. So we have a real constraint on this conversation. But the spirit of my questions are going to be, let's talk about the arguments you gave against the thesis that all probabilities could be credences.
Right. Okay. That's one of the things that I passed over too quickly. Yeah.
I'll start with the second. There was a point where you introduced epistemic chances and you said these are neither credences nor chances. And now here's the argument as to why they're not credences. And you at that point departed from the parabola gadget and went to a roulette wheel and said something to the effect as, well, somebody might not know that the roulette wheel is rigged. And that seemed to me kind of irrelevant, that like it's, epistemic credences, typically different people with different data will assign different credences. And so, if somebody said, oh, they don't know how the dynamics of the parabola gadget works, so clearly, that those distributions can't be credences because somebody might not know, I would say, no, they're the epistemic credences of a person who does know the dynamics of the gadget. And somebody who might know nothing about the gadget would perhaps assign different epistemic credences. So,
let me say something about that. So let's just stick with the parabola gadget. So Bob might have certain credences about initial conditions, but he might either not know the dynamics of the gadget, or if he does know, he might not be able to do the calculation. So in either one of those cases, there'll be an, you know, something that there might be an, you know, there'll be I think we're agreed on, you know, if there's an episodic chance for something, it won't be Bob's credence. Like, you know, it might not be equal to Bob's credence.
This particular Bob you described.
Right. And it's not necessary that it be the credence of any agent at all. Like, there doesn't have to be anybody who knows the dynamics and is capable of doing the calculation.
True.
And now, if you want to say, okay, it's what the credence would be of a hypothetical agent that had, you know, credences in this set C, who did know the dynamics and could do the calculation, mm-hmm. I'm fine with that, right? You know, that's true. It would be the credence of such a hypothetical agent. But what's important for me is that it's not required. There's no requirement that it be the credence of any actual agent or anybody involved in a given investigation. So, and the reason why this is important for me is that, you know, I want to make sense about agents. I want to make sense of a community of agents entertaining hypotheses about the value of an epistemic chance and testing those hypotheses.
Okay.
And so, you know, that requires it to make sense that there's a community of agents, researchers, none of whom actually know what the epistemic chance is. Right. So what's important to me is that the quantity we're talking about might have a value that is unknown to any actual agent. But, you know, and so.
Okay, I think.
So I don't think we actually disagree.
I think we're, that's a good place to maybe leave that, that, you know, there's a possible agent for whom it could be their credence. I want to go back to the other example you gave of an argument against a, you know, only credence's view, which was when you were talking about the tension in Bernoulli's work, and you said that, you know, Bernoulli says that the choice of distribution is justified by, you know, its agreement with experiment. And then you took that to be evidence that it could not be a credence. And so I wanted to try to push back a little bit on that. And, you know, let me expand it a little bit, which is, you know, from a modern perspective, you can think of probabilities in a model, sort of in a model selection way, that, you know, what are the best probabilities for me to assign in my model? Answer, the ones that, you know, do the best justice to the experimental data I've seen, that, you know, and perhaps the ones that have the most predictive power, or they do best justice to data that they've never seen before, you know, that I haven't.
Good, hit. Yes.
And so that fits nicely with what you're saying about sort of a hypothesis that we're trying to, you know, figure out what the right hypothesis to make. So I guess my question would be, why can't we say that, you know, it's a hypothesis about, you know, the most effective credences to have? I mean, you know, where do my credences come from?
Okay, that's not
trying to survive in the world.
So, okay, that actually I'm totally on board with. So if you want to say what these epistemic chances are the best credences that agents with, you know, our kind of access to these physics could have, I'm fine with that, totally. As long as there's no requirement that they be out anybody's actual credence. So when I said they're not credences, what I mean is they are not credences of, they need not be credences of any actual agent. If you say, okay, what this is for a given kind of physical setup, and for then these would be the best credences for any agent anywhere remotely like us with our kind of access to that. I think that that's actually the right way to a very good way to put it. In fact, I'm pretty sure as you know, I've spent many years talking to Chris Fuchs about these things, and he wouldn't want to reject this notion of objective chance. And I said, this is how you should think of objective chance, as optimal credences for a given physical setup. And he was resistant to that, but I don't think he should have been. I think given everything that he was saying, he should have just accepted that there can be a matter of fact about what these optimal credences are, whether or not anyone yet knows what that matter of fact is.
It's certainly the notion of optimal credences being the ones that help you survive the best in the world seems like the kind of thing that Chris might endorse, because he has that sort of pragmatic part of his philosophy. Maybe it's the sort of uniqueness that he's against.
So if we're talking about optimal credences that help us survive best in the world, or make predictions about results of experiments, or whatever it is your goals are, I think that that's a good way of thinking about these things that I'm calling epistemic chances. Right. And notice if they're neither wholly epistemic, they don't have to do entirely with what we know. They depend both on our access to the world and on physical features of the world, right? So those optimal credences are hybrids of the sort that I'm talking about.
Okay, let me do one last quick question, then I do have to run, and it touches on what you just said about Chris Fuchs. So you can't remember exactly what you said, but you started talking about objective probabilities. So let me just distinguish sort of some notion of objectivity from this kind of notion of optimality, where, if I'm doing model selection, then, maybe different agents could agree that, it seems like the optimal parameters to use would be these ones. But they might also disagree. But there seems to me some cases where, despite our disagreements, there are things we'll agree upon. And so my favorite example is this, I think it's von Neumann who invented this coin flipping protocol, where like you and I might assign different biases to this coin, but if we follow the following protocol, which is that if it's heads, tails, I win. If it's tails, heads, you win. So we both assign probabilities P times one minus P, or let's say I do that, P times one minus P for both those. You assign Q times one minus Q for both those. So we both say it's a fair coin flip, regardless of our disagreement about what the overall bias is. So I would say, that's something on which we've achieved objectivity, intersubjective agreement, despite our disagreement about the overall bias of the coin. So in other words, I don't think there's anything in the credence notion of probability that implies that we will always be disagreeing about probabilistic assignments. There'll be lots of cases where we are agreeing.
Right. I don't think that there is anything in the notion of credence that different agents will always disagree about everything. I think that's true. And so there are certain things that are insensitive to, what I would say is that you have different credences, but there are certain features of that setup that are insensitive to those differences in credence.
Yeah, there's certain things we certainly have to agree on.
Yeah, that's actually a nice example. I wasn't familiar with that one, but yeah.
Okay, I should run. So thanks. Okay. Thanks very much.
Yeah. Well, thanks for those questions and comments. So, maybe we actually agree.
I think we're not disagreeing.
Okay. Great. Yeah. All right. Good to see you.
I know.
Bye bye.
Yes. So we're actually already at 30 minutes of questions. Done, and I also have to go very soon. There's still a question by Hillary C in the chat.
Okay, so can I answer that before we?
Yes. Yeah, and this can be the last one.
if you're going to base judgments about the validity of probability assignments based on some kind of survival benefit, what happens if there are other agents in the system? So I guess that came up while I was talking to Rob Speckens, where he was saying that Chris Fuchs ought to be able to think of optimal credences, the ones that best help you survive. And then the way I said is, well, you know, there could be optimal for helping you survive or helping you predict outcomes of experiments or whatever, you know, whatever your goals are. So I'm certainly not restricting myself to survival benefit. In fact, I think that for me, it's very important that when I say optimal credences, I don't mean purely survival benefit. I think that you can apply these things in pure physics where there's no practical outcome. So, and would there be circumstances in which your optimal assignment would depend on other agents? Yes, if your goals are depend on if the goals that you're striving for are the sorts that are the sorts where satisfaction of your goals depends on what other agents are doing, then yeah, you can kick up circumstances in which your optimal credences will depend on the credences of other agents. That's all very interesting and important, and it's part of game theory. It's not something that I've gone into. So I was just imagining, making sense of things like ascribing probabilities to outcomes of experiments and things like that. Right. Okay, so is this a good place to end?
Yeah, I think so. So we should thank again Wayne for the talk, right. And hopefully you get to come in person to PI at some point.
I hope so too. Yeah, so good to see everyone again. And thanks for coming to my talk. And thanks again for inviting me.